Welcome to Soundbites, a series about the food we eat. We're going to spend the next year examining the entire system of how food gets from the farm to your table, including the history, politics, health, and environmental concerns, and the economics of wholesome food. You're already familiar with some of the issues. Our neighborhoods have become food deserts with not a supermarket to be seen around us for miles. Our children are unhealthy with type 2 diabetes and high blood pressure showing up at younger and younger ages. Many of us die too young from preventable diseases. We believe it doesn't have to be this way. Over the coming year, we're going to share stories about our food. We'll explore how farms, both urban and rural, can feed and employ our people, how we can get fresh produce to our citizens, how we can take care of the environment, and how we can create a 21st century food system that is more just and healthier for each of us and our world. We believe it can be done. Please join us as we explore how we get there together.
And this week on the program, we discuss the controversy growing over pesticides. Two recent reports came out detailing the prevalence of pesticides in our waterways, on our lawns, in our parks, and maybe in the lives of our children. The Environmental Protection Agency released its report on the Chesapeake Bay, showing a high amount of pesticide contaminants in our waterways. And then the Maryland Child's Environmental Health Progress Report came out on pesticides as well. What's becoming increasingly clear is there seems to be a link between pesticide use and residue of pesticides and the rise of childhood cancers, soft tissue cancers, neurological disorders, and brain disorders like autism. So the Maryland Pesticide Network has asked for legislation to be introduced. That legislation is being introduced into the Maryland General Assembly by Delegate Stephen Lafferty of Baltimore County and Senator Roger Mano of Montgomery County that would require farmers as well as sellers of pesticides to report information about their usage to the Department of Agriculture so studies can be made of the effect of these toxins on the environment and our health. Over the coming weeks, we'll continue our investigation into pesticides from many, many angles, hearing voices and opinions from all sides as this important legislative debate unwinds in Annapolis. And today we start that conversation with people speaking from a number of different perspectives. We start with Ruth Berlin,
who is executive director of the Maryland Pesticide Network and who wrote a chapter in that report. And we welcome to the studios. Ruth, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Mark. Glad to be here.
As I said to you before we went on the air here together, when I read this report, not the EPA's report, which I'm still wading through the 184 pages, which when I get through, we'll get those folks on here for a conversation. But but wading through your 13-page report, whatever that number was in that report that you put out, it really freaked me out. It flipped me out. The idea of what chemicals and pollutants actually exist in our waterways and what they might be doing to us.
Well, it's not just in our waterways, Mark. Pesticides are used for lawn care, in agriculture, on our golf courses, in our cemeteries, indoors for all kinds of pests. And so pesticides are really everywhere. They're in our land. They're in our water, in the air we breathe, the water we drink. They find pesticides in our drinking water. It's really present in just everywhere.
So, talk a bit about the piece you wrote. I mean, I know your expertise in all this has to do with pesticides and children.
Right.
And go ahead.
Well, you know, there is just a growing body of research that so many people are unaware of about the impact of pesticides on public health, specifically about children. And I think what's of note here is that just weeks ago, the American Academy of Pediatrics, which represents 60,000 pediatricians in our country, issued a policy statement that prenatal and childhood exposure to pesticides are associated with childhood cancers, with decreased cognitive functioning and behavioral patterns, behavioral problems with kids, whether we're talking about ADHD, aggressive behavior, even depression and anxiety in children. And that the Academy said that we really need to have more public health tracking of how these pesticides are impacting our children. Our children are exposed, and all of us are exposed to a toxic soup of chemicals. You've got pesticides. You've got flame retardants in our furniture. You have triclosan, for example, which is actually a registered pesticide that's an antimicrobial found in our toothpaste, found in our antibacterial soaps, that is also found in our waterways. It's also considered a possible endocrine disruptor. And a lot
which means
of,
what?
Yeah, endocrine disrupting chemicals, and there are quite a few pesticides that are considered that. They mimic estrogen. They mimic hormones, and so when we're exposed to them, they activate certain. They either block or mimic hormones in our body, which is ultimately related to cancers, particularly breast cancer, testicular, prostate cancer,
the soft tissue cancers.
Correct. So endocrine disrupting chemicals. It's really a subject that's coming up more and more as of concern. And our whole regulatory system, the way chemicals, pesticides are registered, are based on the concept of the dose makes the poison. Like there's a certain threshold that is if you're exposed to a chemical under that threshold, it's considered relatively safe. So it's only the higher the dose, the greater the poison is the notion.
Right.
Well, with endocrine-disrupting chemicals, that's not the case. What they have found is that even at minutely, infinitesimally low doses of an endocrine-disrupting pesticide or a chemical, you can have long-term adverse effects, for example, like cancer or birth defects. And so the regulatory system, based on the idea that there's a certain level of chemical that you need to address in terms of effect, is no longer true. And so all these chemicals that are on the market, and even the regulatory system as it's designed even before we knew this had some major gaps, this really turns it on its head. It's all these chemicals that have been registered, and many of them are endocrine disrupting. For example, you may have heard about the intersex fish in some of our rivers, like
yes.
The Potomac River.
Right.
And they suspect that atrazine, which is a widely used herbicide in
around
our
corn,
in our,
especially.
Uh huh.
Right.
They suspect that atrazine, which is considered an endocrine disrupting chemical pesticide, is linked to the intersex fish in the Potomac and other rivers. And when you think about it, those intersex fish are kind of the canaries in the mine. Endocrine disrupting chemicals are a serious issue. This is an emerging issue, and we really need to reevaluate our regulatory system. And in the meantime, we really need to be tracking what particularly pesticides are being used when and where, so that public health experts and scientists that are working on our waterways in the bay can actually look at what's being used when and where, so they can really further assess if there's an illness cluster, say of breast cancer in a particular watershed, or autism, or birth defects. They can actually then look at what pesticides were being used when and where, and to really establish further linkage so we can figure out what chemicals may or may not have an impact and maybe either causing or exacerbating these illnesses.
So what does this say to you? What is MEHN saying that needs to be?
What we need to do?
Yeah.
Well, there is a lot of research already, but we're focused on Maryland. And pesticides, which I'm going to focus on, is unique in that compared to the other toxins that are addressed in the report, pesticides are unique in that we intentionally use them to have a biological effect. We intentionally use them to kill and destroy pests and weeds. Unfortunately, they have impacts beyond pests and weeds. So the important news is that because they're intentionally used, mm-hmm. we can actually track, if we make the decision, the state can actually track what's used. And so it's not the only solution, but a major need is for us to have a system in place where all pesticide applicators who are applying pesticides, not homeowners, but other, commercial applicators, farmers, golf courses, who are already required to maintain records of what they use already on, at their place of business, that they submit that information to a centralized database so that our public health experts not continue to be denied the information that they need to do proper public health tracking. For example, in 2004, the last report we have from the Department of Agriculture, at least 281 pesticides were used in the state, over 10 million pounds of pesticides in 1 year. And that was based on a voluntary report, which brought about 55% response. So we don't know what the other 45% of people who didn't volunteer the information were using. So we know at least 281 products were used in 1 year. If you're doing like a fish assessment, you know, like why there's an intersex fish and you're looking at fish tissue, you can't test for 281 chemicals. You need to know what to look for. The only way you can do that is know what was used in that particular area so that you know what to look for. So it can guide you. We don't have that current information available to our agencies, our public health experts, our scientists. And so there is a bill that Delegate Lafferty is sponsoring this session.
Baltimore County.
Pesticide Information Act, which would require applicators, pesticide applicators, to take the information that they already have, just, you know, stick it in an envelope, make a copy, stick it in an envelope, put a stamp on it, and mail it to the Department of Agriculture, or push the button on their computer to submit.
But make it required.
Make it required, not voluntary. You know, voluntary system is inadequate data. If you get 55% information on what has been applied, that doesn't tell you what's actually been applied in a particular watershed where there might be a tremendous breast cancer cluster. And one of those 281 chemicals may be really important to look at, but we don't know what we're looking for to monitor it.
So what enforces and regulates this, though? I mean, it seems to me that you can – there's so many chemicals we use, whether it's on – whether it's people who do the chem lawn work.
Lawn care industry.
Lawn care industry, I should say.
Farming, agricultural, golf courses.
So this is farming, but it's beyond farming. It's farming. It's all the country club golf courses. It's
all the lawn care companies. Correct. Yes, it's way beyond farming.
Right. It's an equal opportunity.
It's an equal opportunity. And, you know, the irony, if we're going to talk about farming, is that the farming, the agricultural community is at greater risk for certain illnesses, which is also in the report.
In the report, yeah.
You know, they've reported, for example, based on conception during certain seasons, a higher level of birth defects in agricultural communities. So farmer families, actually, people who live in or near farms, whether they're farmer owned families or the farm workers who are working in the land, they are at greater risk because they are exposed on a fairly regular basis to a host of different pesticides. And so they are at greater risk for even autism. Some early studies have shown that. They are greater risk for certain cancers, including leukemia in their children. So the farmer community, by just sending this information to a centralized database, will benefit from public health experts being able to look at this and say, you know, in this area, in this watershed, there is a higher level of autism or Parkinson's, which, by the way, is much higher in the agricultural community.
Parkinson's,
yes. And so we need to look at, we can see that the prevalence of this particular chemical, these three pesticides, seem to be used in areas where the rates are higher. Maybe we need to look for safer alternatives, other products that they can use that may not do this. So that's the ultimate goal here. And we actually, there are farmers who are concerned about this being a greater burden to them. And then there are other farmers that are very concerned about this and think that it's so important for them to report this information.
So is the farmer's responsibility to give the information, or is it the company that's manufacturing and selling them in Maryland has to give out the information?
No. If the farmer is applying his or her own pesticides, then they need to report that information. Many farmers contract with commercial applicators who do their applications. Then the farmer doesn't have to report. Only the applicator that they contracted with needs to report. The company that manufactures the product is not reporting.
Landscaping companies would have to do the same thing?
Landscaping companies, if they're applying pesticides, yes, they need to report their usage.
We wouldn't be able to track if individuals decided to use some chemical on their lawns or on the vegetables that are growing
now
in their backyard.
We can't do that. That's true. However, so many private homes who do have any, you know, considerable lawn do contract with lawn care industry. So we would have a fairly good idea of what's going on in a particular area. And, you know, what's interesting is there was a poll that was conducted about people's concern about pesticides. And the figures were actually pretty amazing. 92% of the people polled across the state were concerned about the impact of pesticides on their family. 77% in the Eastern Shore and Southern Maryland, which are agricultural communities. And so we know that this concern is just not yours and mine, and they haven't even read the report, and they're already concerned about it. And so there was also tremendous support for this bill, which is like 82% across the state want to see a Pesticide Information Act passed so that we can track these chemicals and see what impact they're having and so that we can do something about it.
So this is you think this will come to the floor? Get out of committee?
I'm planning on it, yes.
So it's been a pleasure to see you once again and have you in the studio.
Thank you, Mark.
Ruth Berlin's
happy
been,
to do it.
Thank you. Ruth Berlin's been with us. She's Executive Director of the Maryland Pesticide Network. And we'll be doing a great deal more on this. Stay with us. Drew Norman is an organic farmer from Whitehall, Maryland, who, along with his wife Joan, run one of the oldest organic farms in the entire region, One Straw Farm, where they grow organic vegetables. And he doesn't support this new legislation.
Farmers don't need any more paperwork to do. And quite frankly, the information is out there. They could get where the pesticides are being sold, you know, through the manufacturer, through the distributor, and through the point of final sale. And I just don't feel like the farmer needs another layer of bureaucracy that he has to deal with.
But now your farm is an organic farm.
Right.
Right? So your use of pesticides is probably very low, correct?
Right. I mean, we use organically approved pesticides.
So how are they different?
They're either of botanical or biological in nature. So, you know, one we use is pyrethrin, and it's an extract from the chrysanthemum flower that's grown commercially in Africa. Another one that we use is called spinosad, and it's a soil bacterium that they culture somehow, and it controls some insects. So they are natural in nature.
So what would it mean for you if one of the things I know the Maryland Pesticide Network wants to do, and I guess it would affect you, but perhaps affect you less than other farmers. Maybe I'm wrong about that.
I assume that they go pesticides that would include what I have to apply also, or what I'm allowed to apply.
So what would be, I mean, your response to them? And when people talk about that, we know that there's pesticides over the years, different chemicals we use, whether it's lawns or farms, not just pollute the waterways, but clearly remain in the ground, that now they're being linked, and very controversially so, to many diseases, childhood diseases, the rise of autism and neurological disorders. I mean, what should the response be?
My head's not in the sand. I certainly believe that pesticides have an effect on everybody. That's one of the reasons I chose to be an organic farmer. That, you know, I didn't personally want to be associated with them, and I didn't personally want to sell food to people where they had been applied.
So,
my personal decision was I didn't want to be involved in pesticides, and I have no doubt they have effect on everybody, the environment, you know, and particularly the applicator.
Right.
So I fully agree with you. I think pesticides are dangerous. I just don't feel like the American farmer needs another layer of bureaucracy piled on top of his head, particularly since the information is already out there.
If the argument, I guess their argument is, and I'm hearing these discussions back and forth between people, is their argument is that information is not really readily available here.
If they can pass a law to affect the farmer, they can pass a law that affects the manufacturer and distributor and salesperson of pesticides. And that way the information would be out there. And I'm sure it is. I mean, you know, you don't just go willy-nilly buying registered pesticides. You know, you have to have an applicator's license. You know, that their safe handling practices that the salespeople have to, or the sales point has to go through. I mean, the information is out there. You just need to look for it. You could go to the local, you know, farm supply store and, you know, find out exactly every single pesticide that they sold and who they sold to right now, today. And that way, you know, it wouldn't involve a farmer. You know, we have a lot to do with trying to grow crops, with trying to deal with all the paperwork we have to deal with as it stands. We have just all this bureaucracy that we have to deal with now that I just don't feel like we need another layer of.
Someone said to me the other day, they said they think that farmers hate paperwork more than they do tooth extraction.
Let's put it this way. When I started farming 28 years ago, I had no paperwork other than my own personal record. And now it seems like I'm filling out, you know, government paperwork for nutrients, for safe agricultural practices, for, you know, I get half a dozen surveys in the mail from the USDA, the Maryland Department of Agriculture. I'm always doing something, documenting or giving my information out to other people what I'm doing on my farm.
But you think that's from your perspective, is that unnecessary in today's world? I mean, the idea that given the large amounts of runoff and
farmers have done more than anybody else to improve the nutrients leaving our properties and going into the environment. We've done way more than the cities have done. We've done way more than homeowners have done. Quite frankly, we've done everything we can do. You know, if you still want to have cheap food and you still want to be productive, we're not willy-nilly applying chemicals and fertilizers to our property. It costs too much. You know, we have a bottom line we have to look at. We don't apply any more fertilizer than we need to. You know, which is, I'm not sure you can say that for the average homeowner. You know, he goes out and buys 5 bags of fertilizer and puts it on his lawn. Well, it's only $50. But he probably could get by with 2. And there's nobody out there telling them how to do it and you know, how much they actually need. And farmers don't willy-nilly do it. You know, we have a bottom line. We only apply as much fertilizer as absolutely necessary to get a decent yield.
So I'm curious then. I mean, I know that you are a man who believes in several things. One is at least that government intrusion can become very overgrown in society. On the other hand, you've made personal decisions to be the kind of farmer you are, which is to use minimum amounts of pesticides so you can be an organic farmer.
Right.
And have been to, 30 years now?
Yeah, pretty much so.
So what would your solution be to this? I mean, somehow, given your understanding that the pesticides and chemicals we use in our society are clearly causing diseases, they're causing the rise in disorders. Many people are arguing now that the fish kills, what's happening with hermaphroditic amphibians. I mean, so there has to be some response, doesn't there?
You know, I would love to see every farmer in this country lean away from the way agriculture is today. Quite frankly, I'm sure agriculture is the single biggest polluting thing that we as mankind does. And that's more, it has as much to do with nutrients as it does with pesticides. So quite frankly, I'd like to see the American farmer or the modern farmer, whatever you want to call him, move away from the practices that he's doing right now. But on the other hand, the American farmer has made great strides to limit the pollution that he does cause. One thing, this is a personal thing, and a lot of farmers would argue with me on this one. I think the large confined animal feeding operations should be responsible for their manure. So, and Smithfield and the chicken producers and all, they should be responsible for their manure. I mean, that's an issue right now that has not been addressed. I don't think it should be the individual grower's responsibility to deal with the manure. The company is responsible for everything else. Why is he not responsible for the waste product? I mean, there's a good question to ask. But in regards to the question that you gave me, I'm not qualified to answer that. I'm a farmer. You know, on my personal feeling was I didn't want to be involved with the use of pesticides, so I chose not to. And, you know, for me it was easy I came from a non-farming family, so I didn't have a preconceived notion of how to farm. You know, most farmers, particularly the older ones, it did make it easier for them to use a herbicide than what they used before. And, you know, when no-till farming was adopted, you know, there's a great example of something that the modern farmer does to eliminate soil erosion or lessen soil erosion. On the other hand, no-till farming requires a few more pesticides or more herbicides than conventional farming does. So there's a big trade-off there. What's worse, a pesticide or a herbicide or soil erosion? I mean, quite frankly, I think soil erosion is worse. You know, I don't know how to answer that.
Well, I think answering it with a question that you answered it with is part of the answer. I mean, I think that's what we have to wrestle with. I think these are the kind of questions that have to be thrown up that are larger issues within this that we don't address. And I think that's because they're so difficult. And I think that what you're raising here is what needs to be on the table.
Right. Well, you know, as far as all these diseases goes, so many things have changed in the last 50 years. To pin it on, you know, we have plastics, we have radiation, we have microwaves, we have all these things that are being questionable as to whether they're bad for human health. So, you know, maybe it's just a combination of everything. Pointing the finger at the farmer again is not, I think you need to point the finger at modern society.
Well, Drew Norman, I deeply appreciate the time you've given us. You've given us a lot to chew on and think about.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. We have to take a very short break, but when we come back, we'll hear more about pesticides and the arguments for and against the Pesticide Information Act. And we listen to an analysis of the impact that the Waterkeeper-Purdue legal decision may have on farming, the environment, and citizen activism. This is Mark Steiner. Welcome back to our continuing discussions here on Soundbites on Delmarva on the issue of pesticides, which will be debated in our state legislature. The bill will be introduced. It's being introduced by a number of people, and the debate will continue over the next month. We're joined here by Bill Engstad, who is Executive Secretary of the Delaware Maryland Agribusiness Association. And Bill, welcome. Good to have you with us here on Soundbites.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Let me start by asking you just to describe the Delaware Maryland Agribusiness Association for our listeners so they understand who you are and who you represent.
Well, the Delaware Maryland Agribusiness Association is a membership organization, and the members are businesses in Maryland and Delaware that partner with farmers to help increase the farmer's productivity while balancing reducing environmental impact.
I'm curious what you think about this bill that's being introduced by Delegate Lafferty and Secretary Senator Mato of Montgomery County and Delegate Lafferty of Baltimore County, which is called the Pesticides Information Act, that will require businesses. I think we just get this exactly right so we can talk about it here, from what I understand, that the idea is to require certified applicators, government agencies on farms, as well as people who use restricted-use pesticides other than homeowners, to report the kinds of pesticides they use, where they use them, and the amounts they use to a central location in the Department of Agriculture. What's your take on that, Bill?
Well, right now, the commercial applicators and farmers and the urban applicators, they're both lawn care and dwelling pests, do keep extensive records of applications and date of applications and product used and environmental conditions. And those are accessible by Maryland Department of Agriculture, which does a periodic inspection of those records, and are available to medical care providers if there's a concern or a patient that has potential symptoms. So the records are available at this point to both the department and to the medical community.
The argument that some of the people who support the Pesticide Information Act are making is that Maryland doesn't have the information is they're arguing, is neither timely or complete, that the Department of Ag, it's voluntary. It was last published in 2004,
and only about 50% of the applicators and farmers actually provided information, and they claim the information is skewed and inaccurate. And in order for medical researchers to really kind of, or any other kind of health researchers or environmental researchers, to kind of look at clusters of disease or problems in certain rivers, is to have more adequate and required data to be sent to DOA, Department of Agriculture, so that it can be used.
You're referring to the study that Maryland Department of Agriculture commissioned National Ag Statistics Service to do a survey, which they did last year. They're compiling that information to be published here in June. And it was a written survey, and they had about a 50% participation rate in that, which is very high for a written type survey. But that's not the record. So the records that farmers and applicators maintain are based on every application of every day's work. And those records are available to the department upon request, upon inspection, and available to the medical community upon patient needs. So the survey is not the record.
What would be the problem, though, with making that that information or acquired information for applicators and business users and commercial users and farmers to report it in an accurate way whenever they use it? What is the argument against doing that?
Well, to create a public available database to have this business information available for public access would be a tremendous amount of information. A commercial applicator would have millions of bits of information per business across the state. It would be a very large database. And at this point, the cost for it, in the eyes of the legislators and the department and the governor over the last 4 or 5 years as this has been proposed, the costs have not demonstrated the benefits that such a massive database would present.
What kind of discussion should ensue then when you have the United States Environmental Protection Agency's Chesapeake Bay Program report in January of this year? One of the things in that report, and it's an extensive report, very long, on toxic contaminants and the bay, the pesticides are mentioned, that is an issue that has been raised, and people are trying to figure out a way that you can monitor these things and find out where clusters of diseases intersects fish, with the problems they have in polluted waters, so they can pinpoint exactly what it is and then maybe rectify whatever's happening, if that's possible. So how else would you do that? I mean, what's our alternative?
You're referring to the Chesapeake Bay Program, US EPA's toxic contaminants report that was a wide range of contaminants.
Right.
And it really is pretty daunting to see the extent of, say, PCBs that are in the sediments in our rivers and bays. And then the pesticides you mentioned that are in these sediments of the rivers and bays are really chemicals that have been banned by EPA for 20, 30 years, that these residuals are not from current pesticides. So the management of current pesticide applications by Maryland Department of Agriculture will really have no effect on those residual PCBs or banned pesticides that are in those sediments. That's unfortunate, but those are past errors that we can't do anything about.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Bill Ungsted, who is Executive Secretary of the Delaware Maryland Agribusiness Association, for spending time with us here on Soundbites on Delmarva. And we invite you back for further discussions over the next couple of months as this gets debated in the state legislature. We continue our conversations around the issue of pesticides and pesticide reporting here in Maryland.
We're about to have a conversation with Jay Feldman, who is co-founder and executive director of Beyond Pesticides and has been the director since 1981. And Jay, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So what is Beyond Pesticides? Let's start there for our listeners.
Well, we're an information and advocacy organization. We were set up because of the heavy reliance in our country, both in terms of agriculture and non-agricultural use, on pesticides, and the awareness that many of the uses are really not necessary. So we experience risks and hazards that really can be eliminated as a result of alternative practices around the home, in the garden, and on the farm.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute. I mean, before we talk about your sense of what this battle and raging in the state legislature here in Maryland is about over-reporting, when you say it's not necessary, I mean, many would argue that, just on large-scale farming, to grow the food needed, as one farmer said to me, he said, look, before pesticides in the 1940s, we were losing everything. It's the only way we can keep the food growing. So yeah. When you say it's overused, what do you mean?
Well, I think we were sold that line, and farmers were sold that line back in the 50s, where we basically chemicalized agriculture in much of our lives. So we went from really working with the soil and understanding the importance of soil health to plant health to feeding plants with synthetic materials, and as a result, ignoring all the conditions on the farm, in the soil, level of microbial activity, the production of natural fertilization through nitrogen fixation and putting nitrogen back in the soil by using nitrogen-fixing legumes in between the economic crop. So between the planting, between the rows of crops, we would plant additional crops that, in fact, fed the soil. We replaced all that with methods that basically said we can use less labor and really replace labor with energy. So, in effect, what we've done is we've become very petroleum-focused in terms of petroleum-based fertilizers, petroleum-based insecticides, and herbicides that effectively are, you know, have what we call externalities, have costs associated with them. And it's these costs that we really need to focus on. But getting back to your question about necessity, you know, one of the things that is extraordinary today, really, is to look at the growth of the organic industry. I mean, organic, when I first started working on this topic, was really viewed as fringe and really incapable of feeding the world, as it were. Now we have a $30 billion industry, and that industry is built on a different approach to agriculture, different systems that, in effect, recognize that these inputs, these petroleum-based, fossil fuel-based inputs, have deleterious impacts on production. And if replaced, can actually create higher productivity, higher profitability, less impacts on the environment in terms of adverse impacts on water quality, air quality, health effects to both those harvesting the food, working the land, and those eating the food.
So right now, the debate taking place in the Maryland State Legislature that I know that you've been following,
yeah,
which has to do with reporting of the use of pesticides, and the question, what you think that would do if that was passed, why it's, from your perspective, probably why it's important to pass.
Yeah.
And also your thoughts about some people are saying, look, once again, we're dumping this all on the back of farmers.
Yeah.
And as someone from the industry would say, on the other side of the lawn industry would say, 80% of all the chemicals dumped on lawns are dumped by people who buy them at stores and dump them themselves, not by our industry.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's really interesting because most of the agricultural uses of pesticides are of concern because we know they run off into tributaries that go into the bay. And, you know, the starting point for this bill really is protecting the bay. I mean, there's no question that this has been a longstanding concern that we just have not adequately addressed. I mean, we have, you know, the executive order that was signed by the president in 2009, Chesapeake Bay Protection Restoration, that basically said that restoration of the health of the Chesapeake Bay will require renewed commitment to controlling pollution from all sources, as well as protecting and restoring habitat and living resources, conserving lands, improving management of natural resources, all of which contribute to improved water quality and ecosystem health. And that's crucial because there are a lot of factors. Agriculture is a major factor in terms of the bay. That is not to minimize the impact of lawn care pesticides or garden pesticides or other pesticides that may be used around the home and garden, but agriculture is a major contributor to bay pollution. And as a result, we need a strategy. We can't just keep pointing the finger at each other. And, you know, I'm confident that this won't have adverse impact on farmers because, as I say, we have a lot of techniques that farmers can use to minimize pollution and adopt practices that are non-polluting. But, you know, there's a funny thing, you know, that we have to, the challenge that we have to face here, and that's information, you know. And everybody says, you know, why point the finger at me, point the finger at somebody else, and then when it comes down to collecting the information necessary to make the decision and to zero in on the issues of importance, those same people say they don't want to collect the information. So you can't have it both ways. You know, you basically create an information system as would be required under the Pesticide Information Act so that you have the capability to zero in on the real sources of the problem and then prioritize from there.
This has been fascinating. I appreciate all the time you've given us, Jay, and we look forward to talking to you again.
Sure.
Last December, a federal judge dismissed the case against Perdue and a local farm family in a lawsuit brought by the Waterkeeper Alliance to hold the Perdue company responsible for the waste in our environment from the chickens they own the local farmers raise for them. It was brought under the Clean Water Act. And our guest, Sun journalist Tim Wheeler, and environmental law professor Patrick Parenteau, discussed its consequences. Patrick and Tim, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Patrick, let me start with you. I'm just in your kind of analysis of legally what this means. And what do you think the fallout will be from the way the suit ended?
Well, it's a very fact-specific case to start with, so I'm not sure that it's broken any new legal ground. It's a huge loss for the Waterkeeper Alliance, of course. But in terms of interpreting the Clean Water Act, the court basically said you just failed to prove that either the Hudson Farm or certainly Perdue violated the Clean Water Act. And so in most citizen suit cases, you don't find this unusual circumstance that was present here where the suspected source of the pollution turned out not to be the source of the water quality problems that were discovered downstream. And that's very unusual. And so, therefore, I don't think it's set any new precedent in the Clean Water Act.
Tim, how did you see it in the aftermath and maybe interviews you've done? What was the fallout for you, from your perspective?
Well, you know, I mean, we've still got a little fallout occurring here because the lawyers for the farm family, the Hudsons, and the and Perdue have filed claims for legal fees and expenses. Those are very rarely awarded, but, you know, they're kind of eye-popping amounts in this case, over $3 million. So, you know, we've got that sort of hanging over all this. The sort of the aftermath of the trial, the farm community, the Farm Bureau, and Perdue both said they hoped that they could work more closely with environmental groups. We'll see how that shakes out. I haven't seen any initiatives or, you know, offers on either side yet at this point.
Right, and I wouldn't hold my breath on that one either, from either side. But I wonder one of the big things here in this trial, Patrick and Tim, I'll let you come in right after that about the same thing, is that the Hutchins became part of this case, but the real heart and soul of this case was the responsibility that the waterkeepers and the other plaintiffs in this case were saying was part of Purdue's or any aggregator's responsibility when it comes to the pollution of waterways. It's not just the farmer, but it's who the farmer contracts with. That to me was one of the biggest things here that would have, if the trial had gone the other way, it would have been a huge precedent, but it didn't. So what's the significance of that?
Yeah, it was a missed opportunity to establish this concept of integrator liability, which would have had national implications, actually, for the way these large animal production facilities are operated. Judge Nickerson issued an earlier decision denying a motion by Purdue to dismiss it from the case and raising tantalizing questions about whether at a trial, if a discharge of pollution from the farm had been proven, whether he would have attached liability to Purdue. So he raised the expectations, I would say, quite a bit with his previous ruling in 2010 on that point, and it got all of us watching the case with more interest. But, of course, at trial, the plaintiffs failed to prove their case, and so Purdue got let off the hook. And some of the things that Judge Hutchins said in his opinion, in his final opinion in the case, his order entering judgment on behalf of Purdue, was, I think, probably more damaging to future cases on integrator liability than his earlier ruling. He sort of took back some of the things he had said previously. So in the end, at a minimum, it was a missed opportunity, and it perhaps may have cast a pall over future cases like this.
What did he say? What did he say in 2010 that he took back in this case?
He basically said, from what I've seen in this case, it looks as if Purdue's level of involvement in the way the farm is being operated, the type of birds that were being bought and raised, the nutrition and the antibiotics that were being applied were almost on instruction of Purdue. That was the tenor of his earlier opinion, that Purdue was deeply involved in the way the farm was being run. Now, that's, of course, contrary to what publicly was being said, but in Judge Nickerson's ruling, he struck down a lot of the arguments that Purdue was making to escape liability, and it really did come down to this question of whether they could connect the pollution that's clearly in Pocomoc River downstream and obviously in the bay all the way back to the chicken houses on the Hudson farm. That was the last link that had to be established to win on integrator liability, and the plaintiffs failed. And Mark, one thing Tim said earlier that I did want to mention is this claim for attorney's fees of over $3 million. This is very disturbing for citizen suit plaintiffs across the country and environmental law clinics. Of course, the Maryland Clinic represents the waterkeeper in this case because, as Tim said, it's very, very rare that courts award fees against environmental groups in these cases. But there are two major precedents, and Judge Nickerson did warn the plaintiffs here that if they lost at trial, they could potentially be liable for these fees. Now, hopefully, Judge Nickerson, when he has a chance to reflect on this a little more, this is a matter of the court's discretion as to whether to award fees, and if so, how much. Obviously, an award of over $1 million would be crippling to the plaintiffs in this case and would send a chilling message across the country to other potential citizens seeking to enforce these environmental laws. So in some ways, this second phase of the case and how this turns out, or this last phase, it could even be more important than the trial itself in terms of, you know, the financial liability of groups bringing these cases would be a huge disincentive if he were to lay a big judgment like that on them.
And Tim, have you been covering that aspect of it? And what's your sense of what's going on now with that?
Well, I haven't covered it specifically yet. There's you know, the filings have occurred in court. There hasn't been actual joining of the arguments on the attorney's fees yet. That will be scheduled shortly. The deadline for the Waterkeeper Alliance to file an appeal just passed, and they let it pass without making any comment or you know, filing anything in court. So the only response that the Waterkeeper Alliance has made so far to the request for attorney's fees is because of the sort of the peculiarities of the scheduling of this, you know, in the court, they've filed a response to the claims for some of the expenses for copying and travel for expert witnesses and whatnot, but there has not been a full-blown, you know, argument either in filings or in court yet on the attorney's fees issue.
And Tim, one final thing, Tim, I guess is what has been the fallout inside, if there has been any that you know of, with the state legislature in terms of the University of Maryland Environmental Law Clinic?
Well, nothing so far, Mark. As you know, in past years, in the past couple at least anyway, there were attempts to take money away from the University of Maryland or its law school as a signal of the legislature's displeasure over this. Each time that the first time when that was a sort of a blatant effort to take money, the legislature pulled back. They did attach some of the money in the last year that would have required establishment of legal aid for small businesses and farmers as a sort of a in a competing institution at another university, University of Baltimore. So there has been that kind of attempt in the past. We'll see as the budget moves forward whether there's any further attempt to do that. One other sort of postscript I would make on this, which I thought was kind of in some ways odd in a way. It was clear at the end that the defendants, no one questioned that there was serious pollution in the drainage ditches leading into the stream that fed to the Pocomoke River and ultimately to the bay. They argued about the source, but there was no evidence presented either in court or out that anybody is addressing that. If it was from the cows, there was no clear evidence that anybody was alarmed or you know, felt any urgency about dealing with it. The state has adopted new regulations on farms that ultimately, a year or so from now, will require farmers to keep their animals you know, away from or adopt measures that intended to keep their animals away from water. But throughout this whole thing, there was no apparent sort of focus on the water itself, whether it was from the chickens or the cows. Obviously, the trial was about the chickens, not the cows.
But right, right.
We didn't see a whole lot of sort of public addressing of that issue outside of the courtroom.
Well, I think that what we'll do in the coming weeks, clearly in months, is to follow very closely what happens with the disposition the judge has to make in terms of financial liability that might be thrown back at the waterkeepers and the University of Maryland Environmental Law Clinic, and see where the rest goes. And I want to thank both of you very much for taking your time with all of our listeners at Soundbites on Delmarva. Patrick Parenteau is professor of law at the Vermont Law School and senior counsel with the Environmental Natural Resources Law Clinic. And Tim Wheeler writes the Be More Green column and reports on environmental and agriculture for the Baltimore Sun. And Patrick and Tim, thank you both so much. And I'd like to thank all of our guests today, Ruth Berlin, Drew Norman, Bill Angstad, Jay Feldman, Tim Wheeler, and Patrick Parenteau. The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites on Delmarva is a production of the Center for Emerging Media and made possible in part by the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Stephanie Mavronis, and Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. And for WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.